Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we're going to continue our romp through Romans. God's righteousness upheld, no one righteous. Righteousness with God given, justification upholds the law. And Abraham justified by faith. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
He is the icon of suffering in a lot of ways, Old Testament patriarch and prophet Job. Why does he suffer? Is it because of some undisclosed, unrevealed sin in his life? I remember speaking with a fellow Christian years and years ago, and he said, well, Job's real problem was pride. But if you read the book, Job comes off as an immensely humble man, but he does assert his innocence, especially in the face of the terrible counsel he receives from his so-called friends. In the end, God has to step in. How does God judge Job, and why in the world, after all is said and done, after he's allowed everything to be taken from Job except his life and his faith, does God restore to him even more than he had before? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be remembering, along with the church, as they do on May 9th, the patriarch and prophet Job. Joining us to do so, Dr. Kevin Golden. He's pastor of Village Lutheran Church in St. Louis and has a PhD in biblical studies with an emphasis on the Old Testament from Concordia Seminary. Dr. Golden, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Do we know when the events of Job's life occurred in the biblical chronology?
The text does not give us a specific dating, but we have some pretty good ideas based upon items within the text. For example, in chapter 1, we hear about these raiders that come along that wreak havoc upon Job's life and such. And from the basis of that, a few other indications within the text, the best dating would be to the patriarchal period. So you might think about around the year 2000 BC, around the time that you would have had Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and such on the scene as well.
Do we know who wrote the book of Job?
Again, the text doesn't actually claim specific authorship, so it is often thought that Job would obviously be a likely candidate, as he'd be able to record all this, and especially the dialogue that he has with his friends, that had to come from one who is actually engaged in that dialogue. So Job is a very likely possibility that he wrote this down himself, not only because it gives that specific dialogue, but also because of the level of information that you have about the personal life of Job and such. But we can't say hard and fast that it was Job who wrote this down. It could have been another, a contemporary of his, who was given the information and recorded it for us.
Many reading the book of Job for the first time simply assume that Job's suffering is the result of some great but unnamed sin on his part. Is that true?
Well, no, and this is one of the chief lessons that comes out of the book of Job, is it's really grappling with this issue that sometimes philosophically we call it theodicy, about why God allows bad things to happen, and sometimes it's put into more common language as why do bad things happen to good people and such. Can God actually allow bad things to happen if he is just and right and such? And so one of the key lessons that comes out of the book of Job is that suffering is not a barometer for whether you are pleasing to God. For certainly there are those who live pious, upright lives that are seeking to live after God's word, and yet they suffer greatly. Then there are those who live rather scandalous lives and yet seem to enjoy a very easy life. And the best that life would have to offer, at least is how we humans look at it. And so you can't use suffering or the lack thereof as a barometer for whether you are living a life that is pleasing to God.
The story opens in heaven, not on earth, in God's heavenly court, so to speak. What is Satan doing in God's heavenly court?
Well, even that title, Satan, gives us a real insight into what's going on. That is a Hebrew word. In Hebrew, it would be pronounced Satan. And even in the Hebrew of Job, it's Ha-Satan, which that Ha on the front is the definite article. So he is the Satan, the Satan, or the, what Satan means is accuser. So he's the accuser. This is one of the things that he delights in doing, is accusing God's people. Now, in Job chapter 1, he is actually in the heavenly court being able to accuse people before God, saying, look at this person. They are living contrary to your word. They are doing that which is wrong. Therefore, you ought to smite them. So he loves to point that out and to really nail others that calling upon God to condemn them as a result.
It appears that God strikes either a bargain or, one might even say more crassly, a bet with Satan. How does that go?
So since Satan is there accusing all sorts of people, you can imagine God is being one who is just, but also one who is gracious, who identifies himself as our Father, that he loves his people, and so this is going to be wearing him down to have all this accusation being lodged against folk. And so then he turns the attention specifically to Job, and he says, well, you've got nothing on Job because he is pious and upright. Notice what a godly life he lives. Now, Satan seizes upon that, and he basically says this. He says, well, the only reason that Job is so pious and upright is because you've made his life so easy. You've let him enjoy the best of everything. He's rich. He's got a wonderful family. He's got all this stuff, and that's why he is so incredibly pious. All you have to do is take those things away from him, and Job is going to change his tune rather quickly. He's going to turn against you, O God. You see, Job is only, according to Satan, Job is only doing this out of his selfish ambition and not out of any actual piety.
Tell us about the kind of twofold calamity that Satan is allowed to rain down upon Job.
So when Satan brings this accusation that Job is only pious because he has the best of everything, God gives Satan permission, but he puts a hedge around Job to say, now you can strike Job's family, you can strike his possessions, but you can't touch Job himself. So initially, all that Satan is allowed to do is, first of all, strip Job of his possessions, and then also takes the lives of Job's children. So now, his children especially, whom he holds dear to his heart, were told that here's part of Job's piety, that when his children would gather for festivals and for partying, what would Job do? He would offer sacrifices on their behalf, because he said, well, you never know, they may have done something to offend God, so I'm going to seek God's favor on their behalf and ask him to forgive them and such. So Job loves his children. Now he's has those children ripped away from him. But then the other thing that he loses in the process is his property. So this is especially clear with these raiders who come in and such and take away his herds and his flocks, which was the primary thing, especially at the age of the patriarchs. One of the primary ways to seize somebody's wealth was the expanse of their livestock, and he has quite the expanse of it.
How does Job respond to this calamity and his suffering?
So he doesn't respond as Satan would expect. Since Satan is convinced the only reason he is so pious is because he has all these good things, take away those good things and he's going to turn on you rather quickly, that is not how Job responds. His wife responds famously, telling Job to curse God and die. Job refuses to do that. He famously says, the Lord gave, the Lord took away, blessed be the name of the Lord. So rather than to curse God and die, he blesses the name of the Lord. He does the exact opposite. So acknowledging that even though God has allowed difficulty to come upon me, I still will trust in the Lord.
Then enter four of Job's friends, and they come ostensibly to console him. What, in essence, is the message of Job's friends to the suffering Job?
Yeah, it's a little bit of the humor, almost, of the text, that they do come for the purpose of consoling him, but to try to find consolation in their words is nigh impossible. This is one of those circumstances where we would often say, with friends like these, who really needs enemies? Because the central point that keeps coming back up within their words of counsel to Job is that God is just. And so when bad things happen, When God punishes us, it's because we've done something bad. And if we do something good, then things go well for us. And therefore, Job, the deduction from that would have to be, you really did something to offend God that you have suffered so greatly. Because by this point, not only has Job gone without his property and his children, whom he's lost both of them, but also he now is being afflicted physically. So the initial hedge that God had put around Job, he pulls it back even further where he tells Satan, you're allowed to physically afflict Job. You can't take his life. And so Job has boils upon his skin. And according to biblical outlook, when you have a skin disease like that, you're unclean and therefore you're ostracized from everyone else and such. So he's off by himself, suffering greatly. And along come his friends. And rather than empathizing with him or giving him some word of consolation, they actually then just simply kind of point the finger at him and say, well, you must have really upset God that he has allowed such difficulty to come upon you.
How does Job respond to all of this from his friends?
So Job does defend himself by essentially saying, well, then tell me what I've done wrong. Show me where I have gone astray, and then I will admit to it. But until you show me that, you can't. And by the way, guys, I hold that I have done nothing to offend God. I have remained pious and devout, that I continue to seek after the Lord rather than doing my own thing. So there is no just cause for me to be suffering all that I have been suffering.
Is Job wrong to maintain at least his innocence with his friends?
So eventually we are going to hear from God, and it becomes apparent that none of these individuals really have a good handle on what's going on. They all have their shortcomings. And while I have repeatedly said the text makes it clear that Job is pious and devout, an upright man, in fact, later on in the Old Testament, I believe it's in Ezekiel, he holds up Job as one of three individuals who historically have been a great paragon of fidelity and just stood out amongst all people. So Job truly is an upright guy, but it is also very apparent he's like the rest of us in that he is a sinner. So I wouldn't take his self-defense as to say, I am without fault, because truly a pious man like him knows that he is a sinner. And this is why he would even offer sacrifices, as mentioned earlier, because this was the means of grace of the Old Testament, the sacrificial system. He knows he's a sinner. He knows his children are sinners. He knows that they are in need of God's grace, mercy, and forgiveness. And so when he defends himself, it's not to say, hey, I am blameless and I have absolutely no fault, but rather that's his defense to say, you claim that this is all a barometer that is going on here, that good comes upon those who do what is good, evil comes upon those who do evil. So therefore, since I have suffered greater than anyone else, I must have offended God greater than anyone else, and that's just not the case. So he is justified in making that defense. If you're going to go with the false theology of judging you're standing before God based upon your circumstances, well, then Job is right on in defending himself.
So how does God enter this conversation with Job? He kind of sweeps aside the four friends. And what does he have to say to Job?
The big thing that God has to say, and this is for Job as well as the friends, but really as you noted, his primary focus is on Job himself. And he essentially says, "Now, where were you when I created the earth? How, can you really explain how I went about barring the waters that they could go this far and no further?" And then he continues in that line as a way to say, you can't understand how I did creation, and you're not going to be able to understand how I continue to operate in creation, including how I live in your life, how I operate in your life, Job, and friends of Job, about why I allow evil to happen and such, why calamities come upon people. You can't understand it because you're not God. In many ways, what this is it's really a call to humility for each and every one of them, that they cannot plumb the mind of God because they're not God, and therefore, it's a call in that humility to have faith to trust in him in the midst of such things.
We're talking about the patriarch and prophet Job. Dr. Kevin Golden is our guest. The book of Job is quoted many times, and Job is mentioned many times, and the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, Living with Grief. The circumstances of Job's life changed, but God's love for him never did. Job's friends sought to give him counsel as to why these difficulties came upon him, but their counsel was poor. The Lord gave Job proper counsel. He was the creator, and Job was his creation. That's from the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, Living with Grief. When we come back, he mentioned creation. Why does God emphasize himself as creator when counseling Job?
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we're going to continue our romp through Romans. God's righteousness upheld, no one righteous. Righteousness with God given, justification upholds the law, and Abraham justified by faith. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Are you still grieving, even months after the passing of someone in your life? The effects of grief, loss, and mourning are long-lived, even if it seems the rest of the world has moved on. The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May is Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or look for Living with Grief at issuesetc.org. When you purchase Living with Grief, be sure to request the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May.
In sickness and in health, in these days of coronavirus panic, people are learning how difficult keeping this vow can be. The May issue of the Lutheran Witness looks at the wedding day. How does the couple plan their wedding with their pastor in a way that points to Christ, the only one by whom and through whom they can keep these impossible wedding vows? Read all about how Christ keeps his church in sickness and in health in the Lutheran Witness. Subscribe at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Did you know that for over 40 years, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries with low-cost loans and resources? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Because of faithful investors like you, we've been able to help church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations. To learn how you can get involved, call 800-843-8233.
Your daily Lutheran Bible class. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues, Etc. congregational sponsor. Bethlehem Lutheran, Fairborn, Ohio. Faith Lutheran, Plano, Texas. Grace Lutheran, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa. Mount Olive Lutheran, Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Snohomish, Washington. St. Mark Lutheran, Waco, Texas, St. Timothy Lutheran, Dayton, Ohio, and Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues, Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal.
I think this is why tolerance is so popular as a virtue. You can do that from your couch. You know, you can just lay there and do nothing, and you're successfully tolerating everything in the world. It doesn't really require anything of you.
In the 17th century, Anglicans and Puritans made up at least 70% of Americans. By 1800, they made up 5%. Why? They just made enemies by discriminating.
He's saying all these sorts of things that sort of make it sound as though you know, he's trapped and he made a bad decision and now he's trying to, you know, just make the best of a terrible thing. But the reality is he just wants to quit and he's willing to sacrifice his marriage to pursue his own happiness.
The devil who wants to separate us from Christ, who throws these horrible lies into our ears that no one cares, there's no hope for you. Those are untrue things. The answer to despair is the living Savior, Todd.
An hour from now, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week, a soundbite from Matt Walsh, Lyman Stone, Pastor David Peterson, and Dr. Christian Kincaid. After you've heard them, your votes will decide which will be Soundbite of the Week. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. We're remembering patriarch and prophet Job. Dr. Kevin Golden is our guest. Dr. Golden, I'm curious, you mentioned before the break that God emphasized himself as creator. Why is that so important as he confronts Job?
So as the creator of everything, it carries through a variety of things. Number one is what was mentioned just a moment ago, that it's a call for us to humility as we stand before God, call for Job to do the same, because none of us have created a single thing. In Hebrew, the language is rather nice, crisp, and clean, that only God can create, because creation comes out of nothing. You start with nothing and you end up with something. Only God is capable of that. Humans, on the other hand, by the Hebrew language, we don't create, we build. So you start off with something, you refashion it, you shape it, you form it, and you end up with something a bit different. But you're starting with something, ending with something. This separates God from man. So not only have you never created anything, O Job, and the rest of us as well, but also you can't even understand how I did it, so therefore there should be some humility. Now, this also, therefore, because there is humility, there also is to be respect. The two go hand in hand. So don't try to figure out why God is doing what he's doing, but rather respect that he is doing what he knows to be good and right. You're not going to be able to understand even an explanation of it from God because you're not God.
How would you say or describe God's goal in his discourse with Job?
You could say he's teaching a lesson to Job, Job's contemporaries, including those friends there, but he's also teaching a lesson to us. Now, remember that the book of Job is part of biblical wisdom literature. You might think of other pieces of wisdom literature like Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs. And if you read through those, especially the book of Proverbs, you can end up with this misreading that would say, if you do A, then B will happen. In other words, the wisdom of God says, listen to your parents, follow after them, and life is going to go well. Now, in general, that's a very true thing, all right? This is why God gives you parents. But also, you can find in the Proverbs things saying that if you follow after Lady Folly, bad things are going to happen, so don't do that. But of course, we can think of individuals who do follow after foolish thinking, and yet everything seems to turn out okay for them. So what Job helps do, this book, is it helps correct a misreading there that tries to make that all a tit for tat. Because what wisdom literature is really setting up is God has given an order for his creation. And within that order, things in general will go well if you live according to that order. But if you go against the order, some bad things are really going to result. It makes good sense. But Job gives the correction that says that that's an absolute, that in our fallen creation, that good always happens for good people or those who are doing good, and that evil always happens for those who are doing evil. Well, that's just not how it works in a fallen creation, and Job is being a good correction on that. Now, that's kind of an overarching one. Another one that relates to it is the specificity of Job's situation. And this, again, of course, also applies to all of us, is that it is teaching us to trust that God works even in the midst of human suffering, that God is not only the God of good times, but he's also the one who works in the midst of our difficulties to bring about his good. That was true for Job. God was at work in the midst of his suffering, and it's true as well for us when we suffer, whether it be of the enormous scale that Job faced or a lesser suffering in our own life, God is even at work there to bring about his good for us.
In the end, does Job know why God permitted him to suffer?
He never gets a real crisp, clear answer, which, again, is one of the lessons for us. And there's a lot of pastoral wisdom in this. There's also just that pastoral wisdom passes on to every believer as well, that when it comes to suffering, we want to know why. Why am I suffering the way that I am? It could be that you have a grave health diagnosis. It could be that you've been abandoned by a family member or friend, and you're saying, why? Why would God even allow this to happen? And all too often, we don't get an answer to that why, just as Job does not get a crisp, clear answer to the why. And so this is again calling us, instead of putting the focus upon why, our focus is to be upon God himself as far as his ongoing provision for us, even in the midst of suffering, and also how he's at work in the midst of the suffering to bring about our good. Now, sometimes we can see the good that comes out of our suffering. So I've known individuals who suffered an unexpected health problem, but in the process, a more grave health problem was discovered, and therefore it was able to be dealt with before it became an inoperable situation. So there was God working good in the midst of suffering. But there's plenty of other times that we can't see the specificity of the good that God is bringing about in suffering. So we are taught, nevertheless, to have faith that God is doing that very thing, to know that he works good through suffering.
Why does Job, in the end, intercede for and offer sacrifices for his friends?
Well, this is very reminiscent, of course, about how Job handled his own children, that he would do that for his children out of love for them. And here you can see Job's own piety, but also I would suggest, again, that humility that God has worked within him, where Job can see, you know what, I didn't really fully grasp this. I couldn't understand why God was doing what he's doing. So my friends are in the same boat as me, that they can't understand this. And furthermore, it is a recognition that his friends had sinned against him by their actions and their words. So rather than seeking vengeance or holding a grudge against them, Job does what is good and right. He's moved by God in a healthy, God-pleasing way to offer sacrifice that they might be forgiven.
What's the point of God restoring to Job all these blessings, even more than he had before?
So again, this points out that the good things that we receive are not necessarily a barometer. They are, well, not necessarily. I'll strike that. Let's just say that the good things that God gives us are not a barometer for whether he is pleased with us, but nevertheless, God does delight to have us enjoy things. He is the creator. He gave us a good creation, so he delights to have us enjoy his good creation. And with Job, just as God had taken away, now he gives again. It demonstrates that Satan does not have the final say in all of this. It was through this provocation of Satan that God allowed Job to lose essentially everything. He loses his property. He loses his children. He has his wife turn on him to say, curse God and die. And then his health is wrecked in the process. But Satan could go no further, and everything that Satan brought against Job is undone. Job becomes healthy again. He becomes wealthy again. He has children again. Now, that's not a replacement for the children he lost, but nevertheless, once again, he enjoys God's good blessings because Satan does not get the final say. The Lord gets the final say, and his word he delights to give is one of blessing, goodness, and gift.
Finally, then, how does Job's suffering and the entire saga of Job point us to Jesus suffering for us?
Well, one thing we've been noting all along the way is that God works good in the midst of suffering, And of course, the epitome of that is the suffering of our Lord Jesus Christ. So you look upon Christ and you see there God is working the ultimate good in the midst of the ultimate suffering. You know, Christ not only suffers the loss of everything, he loses everything in the process. Not only does he suffer greatly physically, but he also endures hell itself while he's on the cross. He's forsaken by his Father, and yet in the midst of the most horrific suffering, you have the greatest good. You have salvation that results from it. So certainly you see that continuity from Job onto Christ, but it's magnified exponentially within Christ because of the depth of his suffering being greater, but also the good that comes out of his suffering being even greater. Yet another thing that you can take as a wonderful connection between the book of Job and the life of Christ is this, that Satan, remember, he had this God's ear in the heavenly throne room, and what does he do? He accuses Satan, the accuser. He accuses God's people to their face. And what a contrast you have between that and Christ. Christ is now ascended to the right hand of the Father. And being at the right hand of his Father is not about a physical location, it's about his authority, that he bears the Father's authority, and you can also say he has the Father's ear. And what does he do now that he has the Father's ear? He intercedes for you. So instead of Satan accusing, Christ intercedes. He speaks on behalf of God's people. Whereas Satan would say, look at that one sin, you ought to smite him. Jesus says, O Father, look at that one, and I have suffered and died for that one. I rose for that one. So forgive that one and pour out your blessing and grace upon that one. And the Father cannot deny his Son's request. It is a great transformation from the accuser to our intercessor. In fact, the book of Revelation makes a lot of this, where it talks about how it says specifically our old foe has been thrown down, the accuser of our brothers, there's Satan. He's been thrown down here to earth, and so he's still going around wreaking havoc here on earth, which, by the way, he still likes to be the accuser. He loves to accuse you to yourself. But when Satan accuses you to yourself, you have recourse. You have an intercessor. The intercessor speaks on your behalf to the Father. And so also those words of Christ are to ring in your ears that you are forgiven for his sake. So Satan's accusations mean nothing next to his word.
Dr. Kevin Golden is pastor of Village Lutheran Church in St. Louis. He has a PhD in biblical studies with an emphasis on the Old Testament from Concordia Seminary. Dr. Golden, thank you very much.
Always good to be with you, Todd.
It's time for This Week in Pop Christianity on the other side of the break. These modern-day prophets, did they get coronavirus right? How are they explaining their false prophecies about the pandemic? Pastor Chris Roseborough will be our guest next. I've written a column for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Sanctifying your child rearing with the Word of God. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.